Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
All right, welcome to the latest episode of the Shamrock Live. I'm Pete Sampson from the home office this week, no longer at a Marriott property somewhere in a nondescript part of the country. It is Friday, October 13th, a day away from Notre Dame USC. Just a programming note for next week, if you're a Shamrock Live listener, there won't be a Shamrock Live a week from today as Notre Dame is on its bye week. So I'm going to take that afternoon to recharge a little bit, as Notre Dame football probably could use as well. I guess I don't have the excuse of midterms, though. But as usual, if you're new to the show, thanks for joining. If you've been here before, you sort of know how this works. It's kind of our sports talk radio, but with sanity. You can hop in the queue, and I will call you to the stage to ask your question, or you can just post it in the chat like Clayton M. just did. But the show works best if you hop in the queue and can ask your question that way. That way it feels a little bit more interactive. But yeah, I guess until some people hop in the queue and start asking questions, I'll go with Clayton M. And he wants to know, he cuts to the chase here. Is Marcus Freeman's runway running out? And, you know, it's like you probably saw the news today that Father John Jenkins, the university president, will be stepping down at the end of the academic year. So that means Marcus Freeman will go into year three with a new president, a new athletic director, and also a new chairman of the Board of Trustees, which is a bit dicey if you're not the guy that the previous people picked. So, you know, is the runway running out? I don't think so, but there's a significant amount of runway that will be behind Marcus Freeman by the time the season ends. And that could, you know, be impacted by what happens tomorrow night against USC or Clemson, or at this point, Wake Forest, Pittsburgh, and Stanford. You know, Notre Dame's season, I think, has been a more volatile than Freeman would have predicted or expected or even certainly wanted. And I thought that was kind of one of the things that I was looking to see most from Freeman this year, is like, how do you almost get more boring? And, you know, for all the things that Brian Kelly was not, one thing that he was predictable. And, you know, games like Duke, Louisville, those are not games that Brian Kelly lost in the 2017 to 2021 run that he had there. He figured out how to make Notre Dame predictable, almost boring. And the bet on Freeman was, all right, how do you take the boring and the predictable, but then build on it? And I think what Freeman is experiencing there is that boring can be hard. Boring can be hard to build. It's, you're sort of beating back human nature a little bit. And there are a lot of good coaches out there. I think that probably the biggest misread on my part from last week was just like Jeff Brohm knows his stuff. And Marcus Freeman is still learning as he goes. So I wouldn't say that the runway is running out on Marcus Freeman in any way, but certainly there's a lot. By the end of the season, there's going to be more behind him than probably he would have liked to be. I think that going into year three is going to be much more of a kind of a prove it situation for him. Joey H, you are first up in the queue. So Joey H, I'm calling you to the stage on the Shamrock Live. Loading. We'll see if it works. We'll give it a sec. We're hopeful to see Joey H on the stage.
When Marcus first got hired, you mentioned how he might look even worse given the schedule and how that changed from the late stages of the BK era to now. Obviously, you know, Louisville being the loss is not necessarily a tough game on the schedule type issue, but how much does that come into play and just giving him a little bit more of a grace period to learn when their schedule's been pretty tough?
Yeah, it's interesting question because, yeah, that was something that at the very end or the very end of Brian Kelly at the beginning of Marcus Freeman, I sort of wrote like, look, Freeman's record is not going to be as good as BK's was at the end because one of the reasons is the schedule is so much harder. It's bizarre to look back at sort of the end of the Kelly era and just see how few sort of top 10 and top 25 type games that he coached in, it's not his fault that USC was way down for the bulk of his schedule or that, Florida State was way down, but those were, certainly a benefit of him. If you just look at the regular season, 2020 played two top 25 teams. One was number one Clemson. The other one was number 25 North Carolina. 2021 regular season, two ranked teams, 18 Wisconsin and 7 Cincinnati. 2019 was tougher. You had at Georgia and then Virginia was somehow ranked. And then you had at Michigan, which obviously was difficult. And then Navy was ranked. It's like you just look at Marcus Freeman's first schedule, number 2 Ohio State, number 16 BYU, number 16 Syracuse, number 5 Clemson, number 5 USC. So he played 5 ranked teams in his first season, which is how many – Brian Kelly was averaging sort of like 2.5 to 3 during that run at the end. In 2018, he played 4 ranked teams in the regular season. In 2017, he actually played 5 ranked teams. It was Georgia was 15th, USC was 11th, NC State was 14th, Miami was 7th, and Stanford at the end was 21st. And, Brian Kelly's record that year against ranked teams was 2-3. In 2018, he was 4-0. 2019 went 2-2. 2020 went 2-0. And then 2021 went 1-1. So it's not like he was blowing the doors off ranked teams. Marcus Freeman in year one was 3-2 against ranked teams. And this year he's 1-2 so far. The number of top 5 teams or top 10 teams that Marcus Freeman has faced in his first couple of seasons has been, it's been remarkable because that's just not something that Brian Kelly ran into a whole lot. And certainly he lost almost every game against the top 10 team that he played. It's Georgia in 19, beat Clemson in 20, lost to Clemson and Alabama in 20 in the postseason, lost to Cincinnati in 21. Marcus Freeman lost to Oklahoma State in 2022. You have to sort of include that too. The other top 10 games that Brian Kelly played, beat Stanford in 2018, lost to Clemson in the playoff. And then the year before that, got smoked by Miami down in South Beach. So, yeah, I think that, the Louisville game is the one that I really wanted to see Freeman win from a, all right, is he growing as a head coach point of view? Because I thought, that 30-game win streak against the ACC was going to end at some point. But to end with a 5-turnover performance and to see the offense bogged down the way that it did was surprising to me. It's like, the ranked opponent part of it is a real thing, that his schedules have been harder than what BK had played toward the end of his tenure at Notre Dame. But it you can't go out and put a performance out like you did against Louisville. That's sort of one of those things where I'm not saying that he needed to have grown out of that after 21 career games, but to be down, 30-13 at one point, or 33-13. That was, you would like to think that Notre Dame could be sort of beyond that at least. But I'm with you that, in some ways that the schedule's difficulty, you have to factor that in a little bit, but I would like to think that would apply more to USC and Clemson than it would against Louisville last week. All right, next up, we've got Benjamin C. Benjamin C., I'm calling you to the stage on the Shamrock Live. Go ahead with your question.
Oh, hey, first off, I want to thank you for doing this. I think it's pretty cool.
Yeah, thanks for hopping on.
Yeah. So my question is it justified to be frustrated with the play calling, especially with third and fourth and short over the course of the Louisville game, maybe the Duke game as well? And like, it could be a response of like our offensive line not necessarily competing at the level they did with Ohio State, but it just seemed almost too cute on those short to go distances. So just curious on those thoughts.
Yeah, I am more on your camp on this than Marcus Freeman's. The play calling isn't the issue. I have no problem with the play calling. I hated the fourth down calls against Ohio State that ended with the Sam Hartman scramble that looked like a first down that wasn't. It was supposed to be sort of a play action pass. Sam Hartman, as I wrote in my mailbag this week, he does not do play action particularly well. And to have a play action pass where the options were Sherwood, Stays, and Evans doesn't make a lot of sense to me. And then the second fourth down was way too cute, where there was like a hurried up scramble that basically let Tommy Eichenberg time up the snap and kill the play before it started. So I didn't like those. I didn't like the sort of jet sweep counter motion that they ran against Louisville to Chris Tyree that ended with a fumble, because that's not something that is a real strength of theirs. Not something that they'd shown. So I don't like trying to trick people in short yardage. Like, how long have we heard from, you know, Notre Dame's coaches and offensive linemen that the strength of a run game is to be able to run the ball when the opponent knows you're going to run it? And I mean, this offensive line has not delivered in any way in that way. So it's the fact that, you know, Jabron Payne and Audric Estime are just getting scythe down on third and shorts on runs that like should work, right? Like, if Notre Dame's offensive line is what we thought it was going to be, they will pick that up. But instead, Notre Dame is one of the worst teams in the country in yards before contact on third and shorts. Like, we have access to some interesting statistics at The Athletic, and one of them is you can sort of parse out third down and whatever, fourth down and whatever distance you want, and then yards before contact. Basically, how quickly is the running back getting hit? And the one that I looked at there was it combined third and fourth downs, and I wanted to look at third and fourth downs and 3 yards to go or less. So third and three, third and two, third and one. How much ground can the running backs cover before they get hit? And Notre Dame ranks 122nd in the country in that category, and their running backs are averaging 0.08 yards before contact. So essentially they're getting 9 inches to navigate before they get hit by a defender or touched by a defender. And like that to me does back up some of Freeman's claims that the execution has really been poor. I asked Jared Parker about this during the week, and it's like Parker made the point that like, when you don't have a dual threat quarterback, and they don't, there's always an extra hat in the box because the quarterback is not accounted for as a runner. Let's concede that Sam Hartman can't be an effective runner, because again, I mentioned the plays at Ohio State. He picked up the big one at Duke. But Parker's point is that Notre Dame's offensive operation, and this includes the tight end's position, are doing a really poor job of figuring out who that extra defender is, because it's okay to have one extra defender that you can't block. You just got to be able to make sure that defender is not where the play is supposed to go. That's where I think communication comes into play. That's where coaching comes into play. I mean, it's also one of the reasons that I dislike the offensive line rotation so much against Louisville, is because how often do we hear like five sets of eyes seeing as one, or, you know, five guys working as one reference to offensive linemen? Well, that's impossible if you're rotating guards and centers throughout the game. If somebody is injured and they can't practice during the week, then it seems like probably a situation where you should have gone with a different guy to start the game. So I think Notre Dame has been too cute with some of its play calls, but I'm almost more alarmed with the fact that they can't just hand the ball to Audric Estime or Jabron Payne on third and one and pick up anything. I think the last time Notre Dame picked up a third and one or a fourth and one was Sam Hartman's flip quarterback sneak against Central Michigan. That's not a good place to be. Notre Dame's offensive line should be a lot better than that, but the results are the results. They haven't been good in that so far. Andrew R., I'm going to call you next to the stage on the Shamrock Live. Andrew R., go ahead with your question.
Hey, Pete. So yep. As much scrutiny and, I guess, pressure that Marcus Freeman is under right now, I do think Parker is under more pressure considering how bad USC's defense has been. Kind of translating that into like a big picture view, I think that Notre Dame has kind of forgotten that if you look at the programs that have been the premier programs over the last 10 to 15 years, they got the offense, they got the coordinator hires right. Like Clemson became Clemson when Venables came in.
Yep. Or you know, like Alabama, Notre Dame got back to being Notre Dame when they got Mike Elko and Chip Long, right?
And Alabama took the next step from being, they were already dominant, but then they brought in Lane Kiffin to really just explode their offense. Oklahoma with Lincoln Riley, you know, LSU that one year with Joe Brady. I feel like they've got to, unless Parker develops, I don't think that our current defensive coordinator is not, he's fine, but I think that they really need to get this, the next coordinator hires right, whether it's a stud that comes in or it's somebody they develop, like they take a chance on who's got a lot of potential and let him be the guy. And I'm just, would love to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think that the coordinator hires, especially for an inexperienced head coach, are incredibly critical. And I like, you know, you go back to, I wrote a story about this about a year and a half ago where I talked to a bunch of first-time head coaches whose first job was at the Power Five level. And, you know, it's like I talked to Clark Lee, Jeff Hafley at Boston College, Tom Allen at Indiana, Shane Beamer at South Carolina. And then I also reached out to Bob Stoops and chatted with him a little bit about sort of those first hires. And like, sometimes you get them right, sometimes you get them wrong. Very rarely do you hit at sort of 100% on that. But, you know, Bob Stoops was a defensive guy, you know, similar to Freeman that way, you know, where you're taking over a Cadillac program, but with a defensive mindset. Well, his first offensive coordinator was Mike Leach. It's really hard to do a lot better than that. And, you know, you're in a situation there where, like, Marcus Freeman hire there with Jared Parker, just like, there was no great track record of experience. Like, I think you needed the Al Golden of offense. I don't know if you necessarily needed like some whiz bang innovator like Garrett Riley, but you needed somebody with, I think, more experience than what Parker brought to the table. And I think that's shown. Like, I think Parker's in a really rough spot right now because he's in a position where he's not had to sort of dig himself out of this kind of play calling hole before. That's not to say that he can't do it, but you know, it's similar to Marcus Freeman last year after they lose to Marshall and they almost lose to Cal. You're sort of in like, whoa, can this guy coach his way out of a crisis? Ultimately, he did. But that was a really gnarly situation for Notre Dame as a program. Right now, I think they're in a funk offensively. And, you know, whether Parker can get them out of this or not, I don't know. USC's defense is, in fact, terrible. But like, you look back at the USC game last year, their defense was worse last year than it is now, and Notre Dame couldn't run the ball. And that was with Tommy Rees as the offensive coordinator, who, not super experienced, but I think, you know, had been around Notre Dame, knew the personnel inside and out, what they could and could not do. You know, Parker now is under incredible pressure that, you know, Rees certainly felt himself after the Stanford game last year, but was able to sort of like muck his way out of it. I, you know, tomorrow night, if Notre Dame wins 7-6 and it's on a defensive touchdown, I'm not sure Marcus Freeman is going to care a whole lot. But you know, for Jared Parker, it's like, you have to win and bring, you know, something to the party there. And it just feels like they're stuck and stale offensively. The run game has sort of let them down a little bit. You know, the offensive line has been a disappointment lately. I think, you know, Sam Hartman's ability to connect with a deep ball has fallen off precipitously. The receivers have not made plays. Like the last time a receiver made a third down conversion before Jordan Faison last week was Rico Flores against Ohio State. You know, they just have not, they have not delivered at that position. It's so that's pretty frustrating. I'm fascinated to sort of watch Notre Dame's sidelines maybe a little bit more intently on Saturday night to see if, you know, is Gino Gadulli more involved in play calling? Is Joe Rudolph more involved in some way? I don't know, and I doubt that will happen. I don't think that Notre Dame can just sort of keep rolling this out and hope that things get better without changing anything. And Freeman sort of intimated that this week. And when I asked him about sort of changing practice schedules, you know, it was more a question more about like load management and the guys wearing down and keeping them fresh for Saturday and not grinding them down on Tuesday. And he said, like, look, you can't keep doing what you did last week and expect different results. So offensively, what does that mean? What do you got to do differently in practice to have a different result on game days? Does that involve how it's coached? Who's coaching it? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that, but I'm with you 100%. Like Notre Dame has to get the coordinators hired right. I think Golden has probably been better than a lot of fans give him credit for. I realize he's not like new school or, you know, the recruiting chops maybe haven't been, you know, incredible or off the charts there, but you know, like they've signed young, very talented linebackers. But what Golden does have that Parker doesn't is just sort of that track record of experience of seeing stuff and knowing how to coach himself out of a crisis. Even if the, you know, crisis was of his own making in the past. I think overall, with the exception of the USC game last year, you know, in Louisville last week to a point, like I think Notre Dame's played well enough on defense to win every game that they've been in. But they haven't played well enough on offense to sort of hold up that end of the bargain. So yeah, making sure the next OC is right whenever that moment comes, not predicting anything right now. That's paramount for Freeman, especially as an offensive coach. All right, Rob W, I'm going to call you to the stage next on the Shamrock Live. Go ahead with your question.
Hey, Pete, how you doing?
I'm great.
Perfect, perfect. Well, thank you for doing this. Big fan of all your work. Really appreciate everything. So I'm going to go kind of bigger picture here because we're talking a lot about Marcus Freeman and kind of the right now. And kind of just if we could just maybe take a step back and look at, you know, he's only brought in one recruiting class. He's only halfway through his second full season. And kind of maybe look at the perspective of, you know, he's got some great players on the way. You know, hopefully as long as they sign, you know, borderline five-star receiver, borderline five-star quarterback, you know, maybe the best linebacker in the country, you know, some really solid players coming in. And we've seen the guys that he's brought in, whether it's Flores, Greathouse, Love, you know, Morrison contributing early. So maybe just kind of thinking, you know, if we're looking bigger picture here, you know, maybe, you know, if you're telling me that this is a, you know, potentially a season off the rails that could still win 10 games and he wins 19 in his first 2 years and he's bringing in high level blue chip prospects. Maybe, you know, convince me here. Maybe it's not as bad as we all think it is just because we're living in the moment of last week.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I feel like I probably wrote this during the week, but like college football, as much as it's a 12 game season, sometimes it feels like it's 12 one game seasons and you kind of react accordingly. Which is not always healthy. I mean, it was probably not healthy to see because the Navy game was a one game season, right? It was the only game that they played. And you're like, oh my God, Notre Dame's never going to lose. Like Sam Hartman, they're going to score 45 points a week. Obviously that wasn't realistic. But it felt that way at the time. I think overall, like, look, if Notre Dame can this together, let's just say they would go 9-3. I don't think that would feel incredibly fulfilling, but it would sort of demand like you split Clemson and USC. I do think winning tomorrow night is paramount to like give the fan base something to hold on to from this season, the same way that the Clemson game was something to hold on to from last season, where like even if there were huge downs that were tough to stomach when they were happening, the farther you get away from that season, I think the more people will look back and like, oh man, that Clemson game, what a night. Notre Dame needs sort of like a, oh man, what a night tomorrow night against USC. With recruiting, I think like recruiting has been good to very good. I'm not sure I look at the recruiting and feel like it's a huge difference from where things were under Brian Kelly. And that's not to say like Marcus Freeman isn't recruiting at a higher level than Brian Kelly was, because he is. It's just one of those things where I thought it would be much farther out than I think it's proving to be so far. And, you know, look, you sort of see that on the roster, right? Like, if you swapped in safety for whoever's next to Xavier Watts, I think that would make a huge difference. Then you would have sort of like the Ben Morrison story, but at safety. You know, so they still have to figure out a way to close that. I think that if this season taught us anything, it's like, it doesn't really matter what you're doing unless you have the quarterback position figured out. I like what Notre Dame's doing at the quarterback position and recruiting. You know, to get Minchie at the very end last year, CJ Carr coming up, and then Deuce Knight beyond, that's sets you up into a good spot. And like Marcus Freeman has seen, like, if you don't know what you have at quarterback, go get a transfer. That I think is an important lesson too. But like, yeah, I think the bigger picture point that you made, which I think is interesting, is like, all right, let's say they go 10-2. Heck, let's go crazy. Let's say they go 10-2 and they don't make the New Year's Six, but they win kind of a minor-ish bowl game. Like, let's say they beat like Texas A&M in the ReliaQuest Bowl or something. If he's sitting at 20 wins after 2 years, like, that's a pretty good spot to be for a first-year head coach. That is going to take some doing, obviously, right? You know, I think they're much more likely to go 9-3 than they are 10-2 right now. But even if they got to 18 wins over 2 years, if they, you know, back-to-back 9 wins, I think that only I'm air quoting here, only winning 9 games with Sam Hartman would feel a little disappointing. I think in some ways maybe winning 9 games with Drew Pine is like actually overachieving and we didn't know it at the time. I just want to see like from here on out not have a 10 men on the field moment, a rotating offensive lineman in game moment, weird use of timeouts moment, ignoring analytics sometimes but using it others. Like, I think there have been some spots in the last 3 weeks, you know, there's a question about play calling, like I think they got too cute against Ohio State on fourth down, like that kind of stuff. I got it. If Notre Dame can win 9 games and we're not talking about getting out coached or a coaching mistake from here on out, I think that would be a real positive. I mean, in the NC State game, I think we all watched that and saw Jared Parker counterpunch in a really devastating way against Tony Gibson and Dave Doran, where NC State had no idea what Notre Dame was doing. It felt like Parker was ahead on the call sheet, but it's felt like he's been behind ever since. So I would like to see Notre Dame get through the season and coaching sort of feel like the reason they won against USC or the reason they won against Clemson. I think that would kind of give people a good vibe going into the off season. All right, Sean G, you are next up on the Shamrock Live. Go ahead with your question.
Just to rehash history, I actually think having clarity on what happened with this is at least – from my standpoint, it has implications on just how I view the program going forward, right? So with last week's performance offensively against Louisville, portions of the fan base are, of course, resurfacing and revisiting the offensive coordinator search from the offseason and, of course, the Andy Ludwig debacle. And the narrative continues, at least from what I am seeing, to be pushed that Notre Dame is unwilling to shell out money for top assistants based on the assumption that the Andy Ludwig buyout is the reason, you know, why he's not the offensive coordinator, right? Or that was, you know, the deal breaker within that whole series of events. So as that really unfolded, right, there was a lot of information that swirled. There was like that Jack Swarbrick letter to the fan base that I don't really think gave any real confidence or clarity to the situation. So I'm just really curious from your perspective, or for your, you know, from your insider perspective, really, what was your read on that whole debacle? And really, was it just purely Notre Dame's unwillingness to pay a buyout that is the reason why Notre Dame doesn't have Andy Ludwig on the staff right now?
No. So that's definitely not the reason. Did Notre Dame make mistakes in the process of courting Andy Ludwig? Yes. My understanding is Notre Dame was not fully aware of the buyout when that process started. When they found it out, Andy Ludwig, I believe, was already on campus during the interview. Notre Dame insists that they would have been willing to pay it. Ultimately, they did not, because Andy Ludwig chose not to come to Notre Dame. But I do think it's fair to point out that there was a failure in process from Notre Dame's point of view, even if Ludwig didn't want to come. You need to cross your T's and dot your I's better than Notre Dame did in that process. And I like Marcus Freeman's approach there, bringing him to the hockey game. I mean, I've written about this at The Athletic, but you know, Freeman wants to sort of showcase the whole Notre Dame, not just like you're in the football facility. These are the players. Here's our weight room. That's it. Don't worry about the rest of campus. You're never going to see the rest of campus. That's not how Freeman wants the program to operate. But the optics of that were awful. You know, to bring him to the hockey game and have the scoreboard showcase him intentionally was just a tactical error. And then, you know, when that falls apart, I don't think that, like, to just say, well, we're going to roll with Jared Parker here, you know, I'm not sure where Freeman's head was at there, if that felt like, all right, this just, the Ludwig stuff blew up in my face. I recruited Colin Klein. I liked him, but he didn't mesh with my players. That wasn't a match. It's hard to believe that there wouldn't have been anybody else out there to go after, but the clock was ticking at that point. That point of the calendar year was late. I mean, Reese left very late in the process. And that, I think, put Freeman in a little bit of a bind. And, you know, there was a while where, especially after the first four games, you're like, okay, maybe the process to get to Jared Parker was screwed up, but the result is gonna work. The last three games sort of put that in question in a major way, right? So to answer your just question about, like, is Notre Dame willing to pay for assistance, either salaries or buyouts? Yes, 100% yes. I cannot stress that enough. And they've been that way really since the Mike Elko situation, where he left after 1 year. Because Texas A&M was willing to be all in on him in a way that Notre Dame kind of hemmed and hawed a little bit and, you know, went back and forth about, like, hey, this is what A&M's willing to do. And Notre Dame ultimately was like, okay, sort of dragged their feet a little bit too much. I'm not sure Elko wanted to leave Notre Dame in any way, but, you know, sometimes somebody makes you an offer that you can't refuse. So to get to Parker was a mess. That doesn't mean Parker was the wrong choice. Ultimately, we'll see. I think this week may have a lot to say about that. But the financial resources that Notre Dame has to plow into football are there. But you know, I think with Ludwig, and like, fans are semi right to point this out, like, Utah's offense has been a hot mess this year. They're playing, I think, probably their third or fourth string quarterback, but also they knew their starter was coming off an ACL, that he might not be ready to play this season. And, you know, they instead chose to roll with what they got. So the coordinator stuff will be fascinating after the season, to see what these last five games look like for Jared Parker, if he can sort of right the ship a little bit with Sam Hartman. Or the trend lines of the last 3 weeks continue through October and November, that would make for a very, very difficult run-in for Notre Dame and for Marcus Freeman.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
Which little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms and restrictions apply.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
All right, Matthew R., you are next on the stage on the Shamrock Live. Go ahead with your question.
Hey, Pete. My question was related to doing our best to contain Caleb Williams. Notre Dame seems to get pressure but not get home a ton, and my maybe twisted thought is that that could not hurt us, because as soon as you get one of these defensive linemen about a foot from him, he's going to slide step and go right, and I think you're about cooked when that happens. I'm just wondering if having these guys off of him a little bit, if you can, I know you can't contain him, but just try to keep him from like ripping out to the left or right ready to throw a bomb. I'm wondering if that can kind of slow him down.
Yeah, I think that was what Notre Dame wanted last year's plan to be, and they did a poor job executing. But they did a really poor job executing it. And there's a play. I actually did a story with Jack Kaiser in the preseason, sort of going over five or six plays from last year. But one of them was, I think Caleb Williams had like a 19-yard scramble on 2nd and 13, and Riley Mills is supposed to maintain sort of the B gap on the line, and he was right by Williams, who sidesteps, and all of a sudden, like, the defense completely collapses, because you need all four defensive linemen to do their job. As soon as one of them doesn't, the whole concept of keeping Williams penned in breaks down. I think Williams only threw one touchdown pass in two games last year, Oregon State and Notre Dame, and I want to say, what, it was 18 of 22 or 18 of 23. Like, he was pretty efficient, but, like, did not push the ball downfield a whole lot. Also, Notre Dame played that game without its starting nickel, with Tariq Bracey out. Thomas Harper's supposed to be back this week. I think Notre Dame's secondary is actually to match up with USC's pass receivers. But then you need the defensive line to play contain against Caleb Williams instead of some of the Cavalier stuff that we saw last year. I would, you know, even though Al Golden was like pushed back on the notion of like last year doesn't mean a whole lot. It does, because it should give you an experience of how to pen him in and what happens when you don't. And I think we saw a little bit of that against North Carolina State. I think we saw a little bit of that against Duke. Caleb Williams is a different animal entirely from Riley Leonard and Brennan Armstrong. But if you can get the defensive line to sort of all take coaching and play sort of this fence around the quarterback and not get behind him, not let him spin out, and like, he's going to make some superhuman plays at some point. And Notre Dame, I think, is going to get got, because Caleb Williams gets everybody. But just keeping that to a minimum, I think you've got a chance to have some success. But that's the issue last year wasn't how Notre Dame planned to defend Williams. It was the defensive line didn't execute that plan very well. And the end result was him spinning out. I think he only rushed for 35 yards in the game, but three touchdowns, some backbreaking plays. You know, and also like he spun out and then would throw too, like he would scramble to throw. And that also adds up very quickly because it's like as good as Notre Dame's secondary is, I think it's impossible to sort of defend those receivers for 6 seconds because you're letting Williams escape from the pocket. So you got to do a better job of keeping him in the pocket, not only just to prevent rush opportunities, but sort of the scramble pass things, which are so hard to defend. All right, next up, Hayden A., you are next on the Shamrock Live.
Hey, thanks, Pete. So, you know, going into this season, we kind of all assumed that, at least to some degree, Sam Hartman was a good enough quarterback to elevate the play of the wide receivers. And, you know, to be fair to him and them, the offensive line hasn't done Hartman a lot of favors at various points this season. But, like, it's starting to feel like, you know, a quarterback can really only, you know, throw a guy open oh so much. Like, he can thread a needle into a window, or a receiver can be so good that he expands the catch radius and gives the quarterback a little bit more room for error. So, like, what does I guess this is just venting about the quality of Notre Dame wide receivers more than anything, but, like, what's the threshold that you really need to be at either position to be, like, a really good offense? I mean, does Notre Dame's third best receiver need to be Chris Fink, Avery Davis, Ben Skowronek? Does it need to be Chase Claypool? I guess that's what I'm wondering.
Yeah, it's a fair point. Like, I'm sure you watch college football games, and there's plenty of, like, lower-rated receivers out there making plays. Notre Dame's have struggled with that. Like, the guy, like, when you look at Notre Dame's receiver group, like, does the term competitive catch, like, resonate with you? Probably not, because Notre Dame just hasn't made a lot of them. Like, Jaden Greathouse, his first touchdown against Navy was a competitive catch. But I think a lot of times it's, like, guys are open and Hartman finds them, or he throws them open. Like, you know, the Jordan Faison touchdown last week, you know, Hartman's read it and put the ball on the money. Chris Tyree could have been a touchdown last week, put the ball on the money. But what I think was kind of frustrating for me, at least last week, was to see how many times the passing concept ended with Hartman sort of throwing a back shoulder fade ball to Rico Flores on the sideline, including the one that got picked off at the beginning of the game. Like, Notre Dame doesn't, like, if you had Miles Boykin or Chase Claypool, put that ball up there and let the receiver fight for it. But Rico Flores is not that guy yet. They don't have that guy right now. Jaden Thomas potentially when healthy, but that's still not a strength of Notre Dame's receiver room right now, the competitive catch. So I think that Notre Dame's receiver room is very developmental. But the thing that really stands out most to me is, like, they lack a Claypool, Boykin, sort of a receiver who can play bully ball when the ball's in the air on sort of back shoulder fades. Like, there's very little joy for Notre Dame's pass game outside the numbers, unless it's a crossing route and you include, like, Faison's touchdown as being outside the numbers. Like, it's a lot of more hash to hash type stuff, which Sam Hartman can be effective at. But when Caleb, like, it's going to happen on Saturday night at some point, Caleb Williams is going to throw a jump ball down the field to one of his receivers, and USC is going to think, that's like 60-40 or 70-30 to us. When Sam Hartman throws that same ball, I don't know if Notre Dame feels like that's anything more than a 40-60 ball or a 30-70 ball. So I know Chancey Stuckey, one of his priorities in recruiting is, like, can you adjust to a ball in the air? Can you make competitive catches? And, you know, right now Notre Dame just hasn't made enough competitive catches down the field to help Sam Hartman out, with the exception of Mitchell Evans, which is a huge exception. But the receiver position has to help that cause too, because you can't just win a game by the offensive coordinator scheming wide receivers wide open. At some point, they've got to be athletes and go out and make plays. And, you know, that position group just hasn't made enough. All right, next up, Jacob K. You are next on the Shamrock Live.
Hey, Pete. Kind of wish you were doing this live room from the tap house right now, because I think everyone on this call could stand to be one or two Smurfs deep after last week.
Same here.
So my question for you, thinking big picture, right? Next year, Notre Dame, new president, new AD, new chair of the board of trustees. What does that mean for the football program as a whole, and for Marcus Freeman's tenure here?
Yeah, it's a good question, because the news today was, you know, Father John will be stepping down at the end of this academic year. Obviously, everybody knows that Jack Swarbrick will be stepping down as well. You know, Pete Bavakwa, as the athletic director, knows Freeman. So I think that helps. Like, they come in with a pre-existing relationship. And if you spend any time with Freeman, like, he's pretty easy guy to like, pretty easy guy to get along with. I don't know if I would have said the same when Jack Swarbrick came on board and Charlie Weiss was the head coach. So, I mean, but I do think it means that, you know, the guys who took a risk on Marcus Freeman won't be there. You know, Pete Bavakwa and whoever the new president will be won't have skin in the game with Freeman the way that Swarbrick and Jenkins did. Like, Freeman was a risk that Swarbrick and Jenkins took, not a risk that Bavakwa and the new president will have taken. So that I think is significant. I think you lose a little bit of the benefit of the doubt. That's why one of the reasons Saturday night's really important, right? You need to start rebuilding some of that benefit of the doubt after it was lost at the how Ohio State ended, and then what happened last week at Louisville. And frankly, like, the Duke game through the prism of, like, the last 3 weeks feels much more like a toss-up than a game that, you know, Notre Dame controlled, or, you know, Notre Dame was just the better team, or the better prepared team. So that's, I think with Freeman, you got to start building some benefit of the doubt here, because some has been lost over the last 3 weeks. There's no way around that. But, you know, does it put him on the hot seat? I don't, you know, know. But you got to win some games. You got to give your new bosses something to hold on to from the season, the same way that you gave your fan base something to hold on to last year with that Clemson game. But, yeah, it's like we see this all the time, all over college football. New AD comes in, they want to have their own guy as their head coach. I don't think that Bavakwa is going to be itching to do that the way that maybe some other ADs do, but Freeman's got to make sure that he doesn't give him any reason to do that too. All right, Ryan B., you are next up on the Shamrock Live. Go ahead with your question.
Yeah, thanks for doing this, Pete.
Yep.
So I was just thinking about how big do you see, like, the defensive opposition, like, drop off this week from USC compared to the last 3 weeks? I'm just trying to kind of stay positive thinking about that, because like, limiting Caleb Williams and doing that, how well they do that won't really matter if the offense can't sustain and finish drives.
Yeah, no, it's I do think, like, the drop off in defensive competence for USC is severe, but I am really reluctant to get too carried away on, like, Notre Dame will do better because its opposition is bad line of thinking, because Notre Dame's offense has not been good the last 3 weeks. And, you know, you look back at the game last year, they couldn't run the ball on USC with much effectiveness, and that was surprising or shocking to me, because I thought that would be a real strength of theirs in the game. And Caleb Williams would just be too good to sort of keep up with offensively. That wasn't really how last year's game felt. I thought Notre Dame lost the game on offense, and then the defense couldn't hold up at the end. But Notre Dame should be able to get the outside run game going. That's sort of where USC is most vulnerable. They don't set the edge very well at the defensive end position. I would love to see Jeremiah Love sprinting sweeps, maybe a jet sweep here or there. Maybe this would be the time to do that Chris Tyree jet sweep, not on third and one, but on second and 10. So I, you know, USC has a lot of freaking talented players. They don't always like fit well together, but you know, Bear Alexander was a five-star defensive tackle from Georgia who transferred to USC. He's been instrumental in the USC defense being better this year, but it's not, not an overwhelming amount of talent. They do have some guys. The issue for Notre Dame, I think, is like, you're not going to, you know, I say this and then watch, it will be pouring rain and 30 mile an hour winds, but you're not going to be able to win this game 17-14. I think that four touchdowns is sort of a minimum for Notre Dame, and they've only scored six in the last 3 weeks. So it's, they should have more success in part because USC's defense is bad, but it can't just be about the opponent being poor. It's got to be, so it's got to be, you played great. You know, that doesn't mean Notre Dame needs to score 45 points, but Notre Dame has to play great offensively to keep up in this game, to give its defense a chance. And I'm, you know, I think we all have sort of a, you know, a little bit of a healthy skepticism of that after the last few weeks. All right, next question, Terrence M. You are on stage on the Shamrock Live. Go ahead with your question.
I had asked a question in your mailbag this week, which you answered really well with some stats just on Hartman kind of not looking the same maybe after that knee twist. And I'm not sure he's super injured, but you put some really interesting stats, especially on the deep balls, how it's just completely fallen off a map. And I think it got me more thinking that that might be like a receiver issue, because like they just don't seem to be getting any separation anymore, and teams have schemed these like 8 and 9 man boxes. And my question, I guess, is if you guys internally have heard, like, have they thought about more audibles or any, is it Hartman being nervous to audible? Because it seems like last week that first drive was emblematic of the whole game. There's a 9 man box, and it looks like they just did a high school audible where like Hartman touches his face mask, and that means the receiver runs like a fade, but he's not even sure if he's going to get the ball. Hartman just kind of tosses up a prayer and it gets intercepted because Flores isn't really even expecting or fighting for the ball. Like, do they have any plans to adjust to 8-9 man boxes to give Hartman a little bit more of a chance, or the receivers in more advantageous positions? Because it just seems like they're operating at almost like a high school audible level where it's like, okay, my man's right on me, I'm going to touch my face mask and I'm going deep. But like, that seems to be the only solution, and it's like alarming.
Yeah, it's, I don't know. I don't know what their audible situation is in terms of like what's in play and what's not. You know, it is kind of one of those things where, like, I mean, they need to do different stuff at the line, because I refuse to believe that when you go all out blitz or you put eight guys in the box, there's stuff open. You know, I don't know if Hartman does a great job of the check down stuff. Like, I think he wants to push the ball vertically. Like, maybe that's part of it. But again, what are we've been talking about, like, why can the offense score more points? I don't think that taking check downs is like, going to lead to a better or more proficient offense necessarily. And it's like, you know, some of these deep shots, like, it's not on Hartman that Chris Tyree dropped the ball last week, or the one at Duke to Tobias Merriweather. Like, tough catch, yeah, but he got two hands on it and wasn't able to bring it in. So there's got to be just a better overall operation about how to handle loaded boxes. I don't think it needs to be necessarily you chuck the ball deep. Like, could you stack Mitchell Evans and Jaden Thomas on one side where at the snap, boom, Hartman turns, whips it to Thomas, Mitchell Evans blocks, and Thomas tries to make a move? Like, that feels like an easy 4 or 5 yards where you would start making teams think twice about loading the box. But yet you haven't really seen them do that. So I think there's got to be more free access throws out there for Hartman than either what he's seeing or what Parker has sort of schemed up. If you're going to load the box, it's a math problem, right? Like, if you put more guys in the box, it's fewer guys in coverage. But I don't think Notre Dame does a good job of figuring out where those spots are. So I don't know if that's an audible issue. I don't know if that's sort of building in better run pass options. I don't know where Notre Dame goes with that, but I'm with you in terms of, man, this just seems very constipated. Like, there should be stuff out there, and either Hartman's not seeing it or they're not working on in the week, because it's not like Louisville is playing with 13 defenders. there should be some stuff out there that doesn't require heroic catches by the wide receivers to make good. Like, if you're sending guys or you're loading the box, like, there's got to be a quick slant from the slot receiver over the middle that you can hit. Or there's got to be like the stay route that I just talked about, you know, over to Jaden Thomas or Jaden Greathouse, where you have a tight end blocking for you. You know, can you run the wheel route off of that? They've tried that a few times. It hasn't clicked. They've got to do a better job of finding stuff out there. Because right now, I just don't think they're doing a very good job of that. And it's showing in how Hartman has played. All right, no more questions in the queue. I will see if I'm going to scan the chat. Ooh, there's some good stuff in here. Okay, Joey H., provocative. The parallels to Brian Van Gorder are stunning. Opposite side of the ball, best friends with the head coach and former experience coaching together. Let's hope Marcus Freeman doesn't hang on too long like BK did. I don't know if Freeman gets a 2016-type year of a do-over and lives to tell about it. So I mentioned this in this mailbag this week, and I just sort of dismissed the Van Gorder parallels. But I understand what you're saying about, like, they had a coaching relationship in the past. You know, the difference with Van Gorder is he went into his third season, and he had what? The first six games were great, and then it was an epic collapse with Parker. The first four games were great, and it's been a collapse ever since. Parker is much more, I think, a positive co-working influence than Van Gorder was. Like, that's how I would put that. There are some differences there. I don't think Parker is trying to outsmart anybody with, like, the volume of plays the way that Van Gorder did. You know, I think Van Gorder tried to just install way too much. Never taught it very well. And that showed week in, week out. With Parker, I would like to give it more time than three bad games, or some people would contend that the Ohio State game plan was the correct one. It just had a few misfires at some inopportune times. You get an audience from me from that argument. I think there's a lot to be said there. But the last 2 weeks have been bad. I don't feel like the Van Gorder comparison is fair to Parker yet. I just think Van Gorder had so, like, the 2014 defense at the end, I think, set records for most points allowed over a 4 and 5 game stretch. The 2015 team was winning on offense only. Didn't take advantage of Jalen Smith really in a way that he could have been. And then obviously the collapse in 2016 was a disaster. So Parker's got a long way to go for that. For the sake of Marcus Freeman and Notre Dame, I hope that he doesn't get there. No one needs to see a replay of that. But the coaching connections going back, that's not that uncommon in hiring practices. I think guys do that all the time. I understand why they do it, because you want to find people that you can trust and you know you can work with. But I hear what you're saying. I mean, the jury is very much out on Jared Parker right now, and he's going to have to deliver starting this weekend, I think, to sort of rebuild some confidence in Notre Dame's offense, probably rebuild some of his own confidence, and then go from there. So I think we'll wrap it up there on this edition of We'll wrap it up with Phil A's question in the chat. He says, are there parallels in the way Notre Dame will play USC wide receivers as they did with Ohio State? Seemed like the cornerbacks held up well, but Harper as the nickel and as the safeties gave up the yard to the Buckeyes. Yeah, I do think there's going to be a lot of similarities there, but those end a little bit with, like, Kyle McCord and Caleb Williams are light years apart as quarterbacks. But USC does not have an Emeka Ibuka in the slot, where USC can match him up against Thomas Harper. And, like, Thomas Harper gave up some stuff to Ibuka. He also made some plays. He's not as good at his position as Cam Hart and Ben Morrison are at theirs. Like, that's fine. I don't think Harper played poorly against Ohio State. He just got in a tough matchup against another big-time player who, frankly, is more talented than him. USC's receivers are good, but there's no Marvin Harrison that, like, is a gravitational player that forces you to double team the whole game. Like Al Golden talked about this and how he saw the end of the game. And he's like, we were not going to let Marvin Harrison beat us. There's not a receiver at USC where I think Al Golden would say, we're not going to let X beat us. The way that, you know, Brian Kelly with Michael Pittman a few years ago, we're going to take him out of the game and just, we're going to give up, what, 150 yards to Amon-Ra St. Brown as a slot receiver, and we're just going to live to tell the tale. I don't think there's a player like that on USC's roster right now. I think you can play a little bit more straight up defensively opposed to rotating your defense to one receiver all the time. Maybe that helps Thomas Harper. Maybe that helps DJ Brown a little bit. I don't know. But that I don't think USC's receivers are going to find a whole lot of joy against Ben Morrison or Cam Hart. Maybe they'll make a few plays. But, you know, those guys, if those guys win on the outside the numbers, it sort of lets the rest of the defense form an umbrella, and there's not a Mecca Ibuka to sort of upset the whole operation because he's just so dynamic as a slot receiver. Caleb Williams is probably going to make some incredible throws in this game that, you know, a Morrison or Hart can't stop, but that's what the reigning Heisman Trophy winner you would expect to do. So this is why I sort of get back to, I said this already, like, I like Notre Dame's secondary matching up against USC's receivers. And like, how many times have we watched this game play out and been able to feel that way? Like, very rare. So I think that should serve Notre Dame well on Saturday night. Caleb Williams is going to make some plays. If they can keep him penned into the pocket, I think the number of plays he makes will drop off precipitously. And then Notre Dame's got a chance to get out of there with a huge win. I know they're favored by 3 points right now. They're going to have to raise their level of play in a big way offensively and make right on some of the things that are wrong at defensively against USC last year to win. But should be a great game on Saturday night. I don't know how many of you will be attending it. The weather is very fall-esque as I'm looking out my office window here on the south side of South Bend. Leaves are changing. The rain is still in the forecast, but should be a great hopefully it doesn't – well, maybe I'll be in the press box, so if it rains all game, maybe that's fine. Right now, the forecast says 55% chance of rain throughout the game, and temps low 50s, very high 40s. Not exactly USC conditions, but should be a fun scene tomorrow night. Again, a reminder, there will not be a Shamrock Live next week as Notre Dame's off, but we're looking for more Pete Sampson talking content. You can check out The Independent, the podcast I do with Matt Fortuna. We'll have a show immediately after the game on Saturday night, Sunday morning, so you can get sort of an immediate reaction that way. But until we talk again next, thanks for being with me on this episode of the Shamrock Live. Appreciate all the questions. It was great interaction, and enjoy the game Saturday night, and then enjoy your bye weekend after that, and we'll be back the Friday before Pittsburgh. Take care. Enjoy the weekend.